Argument 7. The Problem of Evil. First, we should note that the problem of evil is rather poorly named. It ought to be called the problem of the existence of evil, or better, the problem for monotheists of the existence of evil, since unlike, say, the problem of duckweed or the problem of government corruption, solving the problem of evil would not eliminate evil, at least not directly. It would just explain why there is evil at all in a universe completely governed by an all-knowing and entirely good God. If there was more than one God, then of course the problem of evil would not arise. For we could say that some gods bear ill will towards humans, or that there are conflicts among the gods that spill over into human affairs. When no one God must account for everything, the existence of evil needs no more explanation than any conflict we see between different essential natures, as between, say, a dog's and a cat's. If there is one God and creator of the universe, however, one God who is infinitely powerful, all-knowing, completely good, and self-consistent, then we have a logical problem with the existence of evil. For if God's control is total, if God's wisdom is complete, and if God's goodness is constant and unassailable, then why would, or rather how could, God cause or allow children to be raped, airplanes of vacationers to explode in midair, volcanoes to smother cities, terrorists to believe they will go to heaven, executives to run off with pension funds, etc., etc., not to mention innumerable famines and genocides? This is the problem of evil. Among traditional monotheists, several explanations, several so-called solutions to the problem of evil have been offered. These solutions can be summarized and grouped into three types. Each type attempts to preserve God's absolute creatorship, goodness, power, knowledge, and wisdom. Why? Because explanations that do not keep all of God's traditional attributes intact are not considered explanations of, in fact, they're not considered solutions to, the problem of evil at all. Here are the three kinds of explanations. 1. Totality explanations. We humans cannot and will not ever understand God's plans or methods. Thus, what may seem to us like an evil really is not in the larger picture. Perhaps God is saving us from worse evil yet. Perhaps he is teaching us a lesson that we need to learn. Or maybe God is testing our faith to see who he will reward. In all these cases, it is human understanding of love, justice, and goodness that falls short. Ditto our understanding of the nature of God and our interpretation of events. So, blind to the big picture, ignorant of God's plans and methods, we simply cannot judge. The world he made is good. Indeed, it is the best it can be, and still be a world governed by laws. God's ways are surpassingly wise because he is good and considers all eventualities. 2. Freedom explanations. God, who has absolute freedom, created human beings in his image, which is to say, as having freedom also. This freedom includes the freedom to do harm, unintentionally or intentionally, which is to say, innocently or culpably. Some argue that only the latter is evil, by the way. But either way, say freedom explanations, because God is wholly good, and humans might or might not be, the fact that evil exists proves that God values our freedom more than any of his other gifts to humanity. In fact, more than he values our goodness. God prefers us to choose to do good rather than to do good or anything automatically, robotically, unable to conceive of doing anything else. So evil is simply a nasty side effect of freedom, which we would be wrong to give up on that account. 3. Finite knowledge explanations. This class of solutions to the problem of evil combine elements of the first two, but they focus on another limitation that humans have and God does not have, namely limitations in ordinary, factual, this-worldly knowledge. Thus, whereas God has complete knowledge of, not to mention power over the world in every detail, we do not. The future remains opaque to us, as does history in any detail, and as do the myriad facts about the world that surrounds us now. Under these circumstances, the best we can do with the best of intentions is not likely to be good enough to ensure that the right things happen. There will be mistakes. There will be unforeseen outcomes, accidents, coincidences, and so forth. Nor can we control the consequences of decisions we've already made, forcing unfolding events toward the good we wanted to see and had aimed for all along. To be good, and always and only good, requires perfect knowledge of conditions initially and or perfect control over events thereafter, as well as perfect education as to the nature of the good. Since God did not endow us with any of this knowledge, which he seemed to have kept to himself, nor apparently with the ability to acquire it all, the whole panoply of harms and evils caused by ignorance, error, or stupidity remains possible, even likely. The above three paragraphs represent a very brief treatment of how mainstream theologians in the Judeo-Christian tradition have tried to explain the existence of evil without taking anything away from their picture of God. The question is, do any of these explanations succeed? The answer, I think, is no. Because although each type of explanation offers some comfort, each takes something away from God, as traditional believers suppose God to be. For example, totality explanations, which say we cannot know God's plans or ways, diminish the omni-component of God's supposed omnibenevolence. For they admit that God, albeit for the best of reasons, does not have goodwill towards all people and all creatures all the time. He has ill will towards sinners, for example, at least for a while, until they repent or repair what they have done. Nor does God seem to mind the slaughter of millions of animals every day so that we can have lunch. God's being all good all the time, we realize, only guarantees that God is interested in some greater good, one we can't necessarily see, and for which some people and creatures just have to suffer. Totality explanations also undermine rational faith in God's omnipotence, for they say that God is incapable of so arranging laws and events that no one has to suffer for the sake of the long term or for the sake of others. It says that even God cannot make an omelet without breaking some eggs, to borrow Lenin's phrase. God becomes the supreme utilitarian, arranging the most good for the most people that he can, according to his plan and within the laws that he himself cannot change or will not or even reveal to us. Totality explanations have one more undesirable result for theists. To admit that our comprehension of God is limited in a permanent way, indeed in principle, is to admit that we might not know much about God at all. This in turn opens the possibility that God might not be wholly good. Perhaps God likes a little sin, a little discord and mayhem to spice up his life, in which case we have to wonder just how much is a little to God, because to us it often seems like a lot. The point is, really, that incomprehension of God, once accepted as inevitable, opens the door to the acceptance of everything that happens, from genocides to children dying of cancer to your beloved dog being run over, as part of God's plan, as well as acceptance of the possibility that God might endorse evil. Indeed, God might have attributes of which you and I and theologians have yet to dream. Freedom explanations raise different sorts of problems. Let us agree from the outset. Freedom is wonderful, even essential to human life. Let us also agree that we cannot be totally free. Free to walk through walls, for example, or to change the past, or to converse with the dead. But it does not follow from this that being free even being very free, requires us to be free to do serious wrong or harm. What do I mean? Freedom entails the ability to make choices. A traditional believer can imagine that God sets those choices before us and hopes that we choose well. Now, think of a banquet buffet with, say, 50 dishes to choose from. Is it necessary that some of the dishes, say, 4 of them, be poisonous? Surely not. Let us take the 4 poisonous ones off the table. All 46 of the remaining dishes could be good. All of them could be healthy, tasty, good-looking, and still allow for a great deal of room for choice and preference on the part of the guests. If God had arranged the world so that all available options were pretty good actions, would we not have been free enough? The point is, if he could not so arrange the world, then he is not omnipotent. And if he has not and will not, then he is not omnibenevolent. Then, too, if we are free to choose evil, then surely so is God, on the traditional view of God. If God cannot choose evil, what with being all good? Is he less free than we are? It would seem so, on purely logical grounds. It would seem that in order to make sense of God's total goodness, freedom ought to be available fully, only among good alternatives, for God as well as for us. Finally, finite knowledge explanations also fall short of defending traditional monotheism. For one, they do not make evil a necessary feature of the world, just a probable one. Sooner or later, they say, human stupidity, if nothing else, will cause something bad to happen. Very well. But if we are unable to do the good reliably because of our perceptual cognitive limitations, and if God wanted it that way, the question arises, why doesn't God step in to save us from ourselves and from natural disasters? Here's an analogy. Believing in the benefits of freedom, imagine that you want to offer your 2-year-old nephew, soon to visit, maximum run of your house. You would probably remove all protruding sharp objects, fragile valuables, and poisons. You could not and would not remove all possible dangers. He could still fall down the stairs, run out in the street, or drown in the pond. Because such dangers are not eliminable, then you would stay in attendance, hovering close by enough to swoop in and prevent calamity. On the finite knowledge view, God does not seem to want to offer us the same protection. He lets us hurt ourselves in the most irreversible ways. As fathers go, he seems about as caring of his brood as a fish. The problem of evil has been a significant intellectual challenge for theists for more than 3,000 years, and only slightly less a problem for deists, who must agree that the world is the way it is by divine design. It puts into words the average believer's nagging doubts. It represents the skeptic's best shot in his or her argument against faith in a biblical God. Philosopher Susan Neiman argues that solving the problem of evil has been the consistent, if unstated, theme of secular moral philosophy since the 17th century, and she's probably right. From strongly traditional believers, however, the response has been different. Not rationality or argument, but comfort taken in 1, 2, or all 3 of the above explanations, together with renewed faith in God. Faith beyond the sort that says, ignorance is our lot, so trust, which one might call rational faith, to faith that says, believe in God against all contrary evidence, logic, and argument, which can only be called irrational or blind faith. The theology of theopraxy cannot solve the problem of evil in the terms set up by theism. No rational philosophy or religion can. Something about what most people mean by the word God has to give. Arguments 8. The problem of good. Unlike other forms of theism, the theology of theopraxy proffers that God has only one of the attributes traditionally ascribed to God, namely perfect goodness. In the theology of theopraxy, what is not good is simply not God, no matter how entertaining or useful or real it might be. Crimes and cruelties, therefore, are never justified by the larger achievements in which they might eventuate, much less the aesthetic qualities they might exhibit. The existence of evil is not a problem that the theology of theopraxy has to explain, because it does not posit a God who knows all or can do all in the first place. God, it argues, cannot break the laws of nature in order to divert certain trains of events from causing harm. Nor did God design or create the world as we find it, which is a world where rigidity, chaos, indifference, misinformation, mediocrity, and selfishness are common. In a world like ours, the miracle, if one wants miracles, is that there is good at all. Put another way, God is the miracle. The problem for atheists, it follows, is not the problem of evil, which provides ready ammunition for an attack on traditional theism. The problem for atheists, rather, is the problem of good. For if there is no God in any sense, including ours, then whose image or what thought patterns inspired Moses, Solomon, Isaiah, Jesus, Francis of Assisi, Gandhi, Schweitzer, Wallenberg, Mother Teresa, to name a famous few, to do what they did? Set these heroes aside. How does everyday kindness, decency, and honesty arise? Whence the supererogatory, above and beyond the call, acts of philanthropy, altruism, and love? Whence honor in business and even war? These are not minor achievements, and situation by situation, calculated from scratch self-interest, do not explain them completely. The question is, how could a world without God, that is, a world without, according to us, goodness, exemplified and embodied all around in small and large ways, bring about any of these things? This is the problem of good. While it might or might not be a problem for atheists, we'll look at their reply in a moment, the existence of goodness in a bad or indifferent world is not a problem for us, or rather it poses none of the logical dilemmas that the problem of evil does for theism. This is because the theology of theopraxy does not posit a single locus of dominion over all good or evil. God is present where good is being done, and absent where good is not being done. God is good being done. Some long-lasting idea of God might be what carries some of us, from one good deed to another. But it is only in the deed, and as the deed, that God literally comes to life. God's job, as it were, is to redeem the world through us, and ours to redeem the world through, quote, him, properly conceived. If, then, there is no logical problem for us in the fact that there is goodness in the world, a mystery remains nonetheless. When God's power is our power and his wisdom is our wisdom, when God sees with our eyes and hears with our ears, as Confucianism too pictures it, then the problem of good is better called the mystery or wonder of good. For truly, the radiance of a single slightest genuine kindness is equal to the light of the stars, and it is harder to explain. Oh, stop, stop, cries the atheist. Why do you speak of wonder and mystery? There is no wonder in the existence of good, nor is there anything remotely divine or mysterious in any part of the process. Good is simply what we call those behaviors, rules, and tools that have proven beneficial to the ongoing life of human beings, starting with ourselves and our people, but becoming more inclusive as we do better and in our longer long-term interests. And the atheist might go on, your theology should be content with natural explanations for morality along the lines offered by social biology and evolutionary psychology. To wit, goodness and morality and ethics, law, religion itself, are instantiated in behaviors that are useful for the proliferation of the human species, ones that survive the selection process and increase progeny who will repeat these behaviors, there is no wonder or mystery here. Does the theology of theopraxy itself not say that God evolves? These are strong challenges, and here is our reply. Our atheist is not wrong, just one-eyed. One can explain a thunderstorm in Texas as what happens when warm, humid air from the Gulf of Mexico flows over a body of dry, cold air coming from the north, and condensed water droplets fall by the trillion to Earth. There's nothing wrong with this description, ethically or scientifically. But it doesn't explain or begin to describe the experience of running through a summer storm with thunder all around and water seeping into your socks with every splashy step. Likewise, understanding the chemical composition of foodstuffs and their transformation by heat can help us be better cooks, as would knowing the history of world cuisines. But those same facts have another face when they become the taste of a sauce taken off a hot spoon. And it is actually this face, the experience, that is the culmination of the art of cooking. Similarly, we can accept that our moral intuitions emerged from biological evolution and from tens, if not hundreds, of millennia of living together as human beings. Understanding the process will be rewarding. But evolutionary explanations of goodness yield facts that have the same two-sided character as the facts that describe weather and cooking. One side that is all fitness indicators, genetic predispositions, kin selection, and so forth, and another side which is how goodness actually feels to someone who is doing it or witnessing it. One gets this side from good novels and movies, and one gets it from living life oneself. Such dual explanations are not the same as dueling explanations. Dual explanations support each other. Dueling ones do not. Evolutionary explanations of the roots of ethical behavior might well, if they're good in the scientific sense, help us do good in the moral sense. But when naturalistic explanations come around to illuminate and enhance the experience of seeing, deciding, and enacting what is good, they have a much better chance. The experiential side of the coin is the side that counts as much. It's the side that people recognize and the one that educates. One has to realize in sum that evolution in process feels like life as lived. One has to realize that when the phone rings, we are all suddenly existentialists, cast into the world we didn't make, and as spontaneous as cats. Evolutionary, biological, and even humanistic explanations of, quote, where morality comes from, challenge traditional belief in God. But they support the theology of theopraxies entirely. When God is a production of human experience, as real as color, music, or democracy, and closer than the vein in your neck, as Muhammad put it, God's mystery and wonder do not depend on revelation in the biblical sense. No voices from thin air, no angelic light, no ladders into the clouds are required. It is simply the wonder of being touched by ethical action, firsthand, up close. Here is a child offering her blood for transfusion into her sick brother. Here is a man risking his life to lead a dog off a busy road. There is a woman anonymously channeling her wealth to charity. There is a man steadily forbearing insults to himself and offering goodwill in return. On such occasions, a familiar amalgam of emotions is elicited. Awe, gratitude, joy, hope, pride in being human. Just as the experience of being scalded is not nullified by knowing that it is just billions of fast-moving water molecules battering the nerve endings under our skin, so the wonder of goodness is not at all undone, and perhaps intensified, by the knowledge that it emerged from billions of years of selfish, witless life on Earth, becoming conscious, the light of the stars becoming light of a different sort. Think this, and the mystery and wonder of God can come from something as simple as the pleasure of realizing that one is alive and free and without pain, and at the same time of benefit to others who deserve the same experience. And who deserves that experience? Every baby born. The truth is that some measure of goodness is all around. Every iota of tact, every laugh among friends, every moment of patience and offering of help is an instance of God. Every obedience to law, every washing of hands, feeding a pet, or letting someone sleep is God at work. This is what it means to know that God is imminent and in our hands, that we can walk peaceably and work respectfully among other people, that we tolerate their foibles and can expect the same from them, are miracles that do not appear miraculous because they are normal. And they are normal because they are built upon millennia of learning and transmission of the Word of God, a way of heaven, which itself evolves over time. We need only contemplate with the existentialists our ever-present freedom to do almost anything, including lie, murder, steal, dishonor, and abandon, to see that good doing is always up to us, that it is always a choice, and a choice of which we can later be proud, even if we were not fully aware at the time that we were choosing. Recall the hells on earth that dot human history. Bring to mind the ones that exist now somewhere on the planet. Now look out of your window. Every bird not shot, every walker not carrying a gun, every car waiting patiently for a traffic light to change, every repairman writing up a job fairly, every person dying in a fresh hospital bed rather than on a battlefield or in a gutter, every street that is swept, every bush that is trimmed, every toddler studying a worm, is God evidenced and instanced. Look upon these things and be glad. Rejoice at peace and decency. See that for the most part your cup runneth over, and more, that by your actions you are one reason for that cup running over for others. Call it the wonder of doing. The wonder of doing, Abraham Joshua Heschel thought, is no less amazing than the marvel of being. And it may prompt us to discover the divinity of deeds. In doing sacred deeds, we may begin to realize that there is more in our doing than ourselves, that in our doing there is something, nay, someone divine. It is through the ecstasy of deeds that we learn to be certain of the hearness of God. That was Abraham Joshua Heschel.